Welcome to the D&D Podcast. I'm Jeremy Crawford, D&D developer at Wizards of the Coast, and today I'm joined by Stephen Schubert, the lead developer for Dungeons & Dragons. And today, in this special podcast, we are going to focus specifically on the Class Compendium series that it's been appearing in Dragon Magazine online. And this is a series where we took five of the classes from the 4th edition Player's Handbook, took a second look at them, and added some story text to them in the style of two books we released last year, Heroes of the Fallen Lands and Heroes of the Forgotten Kingdoms. And we also made some mechanical adjustments to the five classes, those classes being the Warlord, the Fighter, the Cleric, the Rogue, and the Wizard. Today, we're also going to specifically take a look at community feedback to changes that released this week for the Cleric. And for that portion of the podcast, we will be putting on our flame retardant vests. First thing we'll talk about is the class compendium process overall. Shu, and I should explain to everyone that in case people haven't heard before on podcasts that we here at the office, we usually call Stephen Shu.
Yes.
What can you tell our listeners about how the class compendium started and how it ended up with the series of articles we have now?
So as you know, we took the initiative to look at the Player's Handbook classes and start figuring out which parts of the Player's Handbook fell outside of our intended design parameters. If you think about it, I've explained this on whiteboards all through the office in the last few days, but we always have a target power level for any given rules element, a feat, a paragon path, a power. And because of the way design works, we don't always hit that target exactly. We get a little bit above, a little bit below, and usually we're close, and close enough is pretty good in the D&D game. But occasionally those numbers get too high or the effect is just too powerful for a power at its level, so much so that it crowds out everything else that we might try to create. Part of the process for going through the class compendium not only was to clarify some of the language and fix some of the smaller
things that were maybe causing trip-ups in play or powers that were hard to understand, we sought to clarify those.
Yeah, some of the smaller issues with powers that prevented them from working correctly. Mm-hmm. We also took the opportunity to change some of the damage numbers so that they were a little less egregious in some cases. Note that in this process, we did do a number of reductions in damage, but especially with this first pass through it, we didn't do as much with the buffing of powers that came in far below the expectations. That's something we can continue to look at going forward, though.
Mm-hmm. Now, originally when we were working on Class Compendium, it was a book, and as some of our listeners know, the book then vanished for a while and was reborn as this series of articles.
So, of course, we started this process by looking at those five classes, the Fighter, the Warlord, the Cleric, the Rogue, and the Wizard. We have also since taken a look at the Warlock, which we can talk a little bit more about maybe later. And we knew, of course, going in that after we had gone through this revision process, that the Cleric was going to be the class that would generate the most feedback from the community. It has the longest list of changes of any class, although even as long as the list is, it's not as if we're changing every element of the powers in the class. But we knew that it would be perceived as a negative thing by the fans, and a lot of the feedback we've seen in the last couple of days has proven that to be true, right? We are, of course, listening and evaluating everything that the fans are telling us.
So this week, after we released the changes for the Cleric, we solicited feedback because the response online was hot.
I'm not sure that we solicited it so much as it was offered freely.
Yes, but then we did ask that people send us in specific questions that they would like us to address this podcast. And so I have a list here, and we will get to as many as we can in the short time that we have for the podcast today. And I will go ahead and dive right into the questions. I'm going to start off with a general question. And so question number one, people would like some visibility into your decision-making process. For purposes of the podcast, you could talk about some of the big picture concerns over the PH Cleric that prompted the changes? Was there a sense in R&D that the cleric was overpowered, being played by too many players, crowding out other leaders, or crowding out controllers? All or none of the above?
So first, I'd take a step back and suggest that I don't think this is an indication, the changes that we made for the cleric are an indication that we thought the class in general was overpowered. I think the cleric does a reasonable job of providing a healer for a party. And
arguably the best healer in the game.
Right. It just happens to be that the cleric had a few of its powers nerfed, but none of those were necessarily leader-specific powers, or very few of them were.
Now, the thing that those powers do have in common, the ones that had some of their damage reduced or their areas of effect, is that many of them were really controller powers. Mm-hmm. And many of our fans are right in that the Player's Handbook cleric, especially the Wisdom cleric, has a secondary role of controller.
Sure.
And the bit of this question that does ring true is there were a few of those powers that if you took them and just grab a wizard power at the same level, many of them weren't just equal to the wizard's power at that level. They were better.
They were clearly better, right?
And so the cleric wasn't being secondary controller when using those powers. The cleric was being primary controller.
Right. And in our evaluation, a power like Astral Storm, which was one that received nerfs from many different directions,
yes,
was pretty egregious in what it did. Mm-hmm. It did close to what we would anticipate being single target damage to a large area and hit enemies only, right? Mm-hmm. That it was a very powerful AoE damage power. And that's the kind of power that the wizard players at the tables in the epic play that we've seen, they want that power. They're multi-class to get that power if what they want to do is damage, right? So that's one of the concerns about some of the powers that the cleric had was that they were really stepping on the toes of what the wizard should do.
Now, and Astral Storm is a great example of a power that had a number of knobs, you know, area of effect, damage, targeting.
Mm-hmm.
And we did make adjustments on just about every knob in that power. And
yeah, that's true.
And
we might have been a little overzealous in that regard. And there are a couple of places where I know we have... when we made changes to the powers, we reduced area and we reduced the ability to target your enemies only, or we dropped damage. In some cases, those powers are still very good powers.
Yes.
But in Astral Storm's case, maybe it's too much. Not sure yet.
And that's something that will be of interest probably to many of our listeners, that we are watching the feedback carefully and seeing... Where is the perfect bullseye for some of the fine-tuning on particularly the powers that have multiple knobs?
Right.
There are other powers that maybe just had just a straight-up damage reduction, and usually it's because the power was simply doing too much damage.
Or a power like Sacred Word, which, I mean, it was a burst 5 that would stun every target. And one of the things we do know from our play is that AoE stun powers, well... players love them because, of course, you want to be able to stun everything in the world. They're really just too good. They destroy encounters, and we like to have a game where everyone at the table is having fun, including the DM. And if the DM gets all of his monsters shut down by one power, it starts to get less fun.
And the change to that power is actually a part of a larger evaluation of AoE stuns in the game.
Yes.
Because people who saw the wizard power, it's an epic power, Legion's Hold,
mm-hmm.
That appeared in the Player's Handbook but then reappeared in Heroes of the Fallen Lands, will see that what used to be a gigantic AoE stun, I believe it was Close Burst 20,
right,
became a power that instead dazed and immobilized.
Right.
And so again, that's a great example of the cleric not being specifically targeted, but the cleric being a part of a larger effort to get some of these effects under control.
And if you think about a lot of the ways we've been designing, it feels like it's not connected, but I think it is, solo monsters. We've started creating solo monsters that have ways to get around dazes and stuns and dominate conditions, because if you are able to, if you're fighting a solo monster and it's the only monster you fight, if you're able to eliminate the challenge of the combat even for a round, that's very powerful. And it shouldn't be easier to do that to Orcus than it than a group of demi-liches that are under his command or something. So in that regard, though, we want to avoid powers that can truly shut down an encounter with one player doing that.
All right, another question from the community. What do you see as the altered cleric's strength? How does the Templar differentiate itself from the warlord, bard, artificer, or another leader? The cleric was already considered to be a second-choice leader compared to the warlord, and these changes appear to widen that gap rather than close it.
It's a good question. Now, I will, on the one hand, suggest that the cleric is not significantly altered. Some of its powers, 7 or 8 of them, have been reduced in their effectiveness, but they're still very effective powers, or can be in the right situations. And the cleric is still a very good healer.
And a very desirable healer.
Yes.
I mean, I certainly take seriously the perspective that like the warlord being a leader with a very strong shtick. But in every group I've been in, no one has ever been sorry if a cleric is there, sometimes as the sole leader or sometimes in addition to a warlord or a bard or some other leader.
Sure.
Because, and this is true in my home campaign, the bard might have you know, awesome abilities to let other people take actions or, you know, other forms of target designation. But when it comes to healing somebody, nobody heals like the cleric.
Yeah, and as a single target healer is pretty strong. The shaman and the artificer have advantages in moving healing around to characters that don't have healing surges remaining,
right.
and there's a lot of utility there.
Mm-hmm.
But the cleric can still lay down heals that are very good.
Yeah. And also the cleric, as we mentioned before, differentiates itself from the other leaders by having this controller aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this is particularly true of the wisdom cleric in Player's Handbook 1. The war priest variants sort of lean this way and that,
mm-hmm.
Depending on domain. Some lean more toward defender, others lead maybe even a bit toward striker.
And channel divinity is also something that can provide clerics a bit of a differentiation as well, right? In the standard cleric, if you're fighting undead, you still have turn undead that can be used in those undead encounters, which is basically another free encounter power.
The cleric that I played for about almost 2 years, starting at when the edition came out, and it was in our lunchtime game here at the office. It was Mike's Greyhawk campaign. My cleric, Cornelius, was probably my favorite 4th edition character I've played, partly because he was such a batty old man. But I misspoke a moment ago and called him my wizard because the joke in the group was that he was the wizard, because he had such amazing control. And I will add, none of his amazing control came from any of the powers that were nerfed in this week's update.
Except for Consecrated Ground.
Yes, Consecrated Ground, thank you for the reminder, was a favorite tool of his.
And I felt dirty every time I used it.
I always apologized to the table for cheating. But I loved using it.
Yeah, there is a cleric in my weekly game that I run, and he's a tremendous healer. He's also using Pacifist Healer, which is something we'll talk about in a moment, I'm sure.
Well, actually, let's talk about Pacifist Healer right now.
Yeah.
We did receive 2 questions pertaining to Pacifist Healer.
Yeah, there was a lot of discussion because as those of you familiar with the updates might have noted, the Divine keyword was pulled out of the healing word power from the cleric, which was also a change that was made in Heroes of the Fallen Lands.
Yeah, this wasn't actually a change that was a part of this week's update. This occurred last year,
right?
When healing word became essentially a multi-class power,
right?
Because it's also now used by the druid,
mm-hmm.
and so yes, as a consequence, suddenly healing word does not work either with the pacifist healer feat from Divine Power or the beatific healer feat from the same book.
Right, and Jeremy, you and I both know that we've already discussed that when we were talking about the changes in the cleric and realized that we do need to issue updates for that, and we will to allow those to those two feats to be used by clerics. But clearly they are intended for clerics to use with their healing powers, including healing word.
Yeah, this is a case of unfortunate timing, because we already have changes for both of those feats in the system, but they aren't hitting the tools until sometime after the cleric update.
Right.
But yes, everyone rest assured, the intent is indeed for Pacifist Healer and Beatific Healer to work with Healing Word, and that will be rectified soon. We got several questions about Turn Undead. I'll ask the most succinct of the questions. Turn Undead needed to be toned down, but why was it cut down this much?
That's a perfectly valid question. It is one of the more dramatic nerfs in the class, but it is clear that the Turn Undead, as printed in the Player's Handbook, is, in its circumstance, better than pretty much every daily power that you have. The fact that you can do more radiant damage than most of your day or all of your daily powers to a very large and increasingly large area of effect, and push the affected targets away and immobilize them, and not as many ranged attackers in the undead variety as well. So you end up with a situation where you're basically stunning a large group of monsters. We've already talked a bit about the stun problem. So it was clearly just too good. It was better than any power you had if you were fighting undead. Some people would suggest, well, maybe it's not that good because it only comes into play when you're fighting undead. Well, that's possibly true, but it's not really a good way to balance the power. It means that in the Ravenloft game, the cleric would every encounter win from the get-go, whereas in the Dark Sun, well, no clerics in Dark Sun, but in the standard FR campaign, maybe they get to use it once per adventure, and they feel like they really shine then, but it doesn't feel like it's that often, so they don't think that they need to be nerfed all that much. But in the specialized undead hunting campaign, this power is a beating.
Yeah. And in fact, going back to my beloved Cornelius, in Mike's campaign, there were a number of encounters when we were in this ghoul warren where basically my old man tottered in there and essentially just ended the encounter.
Right.
Almost single-handedly using Turn Undead.
So we did nerf it. We brought it down to a level of damage that's more on par with your encounter attack powers, and we removed the very large burst size that you're getting at the top end. It's important to note that even though we nerfed the damage and it might be on par now or merely on par with your best encounter powers, it's still doing radiant damage, which is going to be affecting pretty much everyone you're targeting with this power, and it's still a tremendous amount of damage. It's probably better than any of your encounter powers that you have available when you are fighting undead. So I still believe it's a very valid option, especially as a free encounter attack power that the cleric gets.
And it still compares very well to the other divine classes' equivalents to this power. Mm-hmm. I mean, we also have the Abjure Undead power in the game. The War Priest has Smite Undead.
Right.
And there are several others. And Turn Undead still holds its own in that family of powers.
Yeah. It also had, and I know we had a couple of questions related to how we evaluate given game elements, and there is a uniqueness about Turn Undead in that it's a channel divinity power, and there are other ways that characters can use Paragon Paths or other powers to regain their channel divinity powers. And again, if it were not nerfed, then you've got situations where if you know you're fighting a lot of undead, you can build up your cleric to, you know, blow up everybody and then the next round do it all over again. So we are certainly aware of a lot of the combinations. And while some of the combinations is fun building, you know, nice overpowered characters, in some cases it gets to be a little too much.
And not to mention Turn Undead, when combined with some feats from Divine Power, and some members of the community have pointed this out, could also be used to attack not only demons,
yes,
but all sorts of elementals.
Exactly. So it's not limited to just the Ravenloft campaigns, right?
Right.
It is the Alcadim campaign where you're fighting lots of elemental creatures, and now it's overpowered.
Yeah. One of the questions we received was, it's funny, it's actually a request possibly for a nerf. The Divine Oracle Paragon Path is one of the few things many people agreed was causing problems. Why was it left unchanged?
Right, and there are actually two aspects of the Divine Oracle that we needed to consider as part of this. One of which is the 16th level ability to roll twice on all your will attacks, which is a pretty big accuracy increase. We feel it's offset a little bit by the fact that if you miss about a quarter of the time, or maybe a little less than that, if you miss with both attack rolls, then you daze yourself, right? And we went a little back and forth on whether or not that should be related to cleric powers only. I believe that the database currently has one of those versions.
Yes, in fact, the database currently says that it only applies to cleric powers and divine oracle powers. But the PDF on Dragon is currently the official text, which is left unchanged from the player's handbook.
The other issue is the Prophecy of Doom power, which is the 11th level encounter power. The cleric uses his standard action to then allow the next person to hit the target to automatically critical hit. That's really powerful. And trading your standard action to effectively get at least a full attack's worth of damage out for free, no attack roll needed, that's a pretty good swing for a cleric to make. Even better if the target or the person that takes advantage of it is somebody like, say, the executioner assassin who decides to use his assassin strike in the middle of that whole process and automatically crits with all of his dice, and it can get out of control. And that's something that we need to consider, whether that should be limited in its attack type. But for instance, maybe you can only crit with at-will attack powers. Even then, though, we know there are issues with the Slayer and other classes that are adding on to at-will attacks, that they can still overpower that particular feature by throwing Power Strike or Assassin Strike or whatever on top of their basic attacks. So that one isn't exactly an easy problem to solve, I guess. So yeah, that is sort of those two issues. It's still it's a fine Paragon Path right now because we haven't technically changed anything in it.
Yeah, but I guess the bottom line is we are still looking at the Divine Oracle.
Right.
The change that went into the database and then is not actually the official change. We weren't pleased with it because we know a lot of non-clerics, or rather people who've multiclassed into cleric, have taken this Paragon Path. Mm-hmm. Not just for its effectiveness in play, but because it fit the story of their character. The Divine Oracle fits for many wizards. The abilities are very appropriate for the wizard, as well as some of our other spellcasters. And so we were hesitant to make a change that would suddenly nullify a person's how they've constructed their character.
Yeah, and it's also a path that has some mechanics. I mean, a lot of mechanics can be abused, obviously, but the Divine Oracle has a couple of mechanics that in a quote-unquote standard party, a group of regular Joes that sit around and play D&D, this isn't actually that powerful, right? But as soon as you throw an optimizer into the mix, if a guy at your table is really trying to eke out every little bit of advantage, it can be a very, very powerful Paragon Path. So it is one of those that has a tremendous range. It's hard to bring down the optimizer without also destroying the average Joe that thinks that path is fun, mm-hmm. as opposed to potentially broken. So while we're on the subject of Paragon Paths, one of the changes we also made in this process was sort of clearing up a little bit of the identity crisis that a couple of the Paragon Paths had as it related to being for strength clerics or wisdom clerics. The Angelic Avenger, for example, had an attack that was an implement wisdom attack as the 11th level encounter power, but then also had the daily attack power at level 20 was a strength attack, or there was a weapon attack. And we know that people never really built their characters to be both implement and weapon users and kept their wisdom and strength up, right? That particular path was good for no one, or at least one element of that path would make somebody have a sad face for that particular level. So
and everything about the path was screaming for it to swing in the right direction of the strength cleric.
Well, and given that the strength cleric, if the player's handbook is taken on its own, the strength cleric had very few options or zero.
it was much closer to zero than right. few.
So we did make an effort to clarify that the Angelic Avenger could be a strength option for the for characters, and I think that worked out pretty well. It did get one big nerf, right? I mean, the Astral Wave, is it?
Right? Yes, Astral Wave, the Close Burst 8, yeah. Which is, in other words, everyone in the encounter.
Yeah, a close burst, when we see the words Close Burst followed by the number 8, generally, it at least makes me cringe, especially if it's something that's not just like targeting one guy, right? If it targets everybody or every enemy.
And this goes back to sort of the big picture, how some of the changes that are going on in the cleric are changes that are not only in this class compendium series, but some of our attentive readers will probably even have noticed them in some of our newer powers that we've released in the past year. They'll notice that bursts and blasts, particularly bursts, have been getting smaller. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because we know that early in fourth edition design, there was this idea that bursts should just get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Right, because we had this assumption that at the epic tier, of course, your battlefields will be larger and your characters will be more spread out. And as we continue to play, and especially as we get into epic tier more and more, and we see people playing in playtests, we're playing in our home campaigns with epic games, it's actually not true, right? My table hasn't gotten any larger.
Right.
And if I'm dropping miniatures down on it, right, the best I can do is maybe get 30 inches apart, 30 squares apart on the table, right? And something that's burst 8 takes up half of that space. It makes tactical movement just completely unnecessary. So we wanted to emphasize that we've been emphasizing that with our new design, but also as we went through the player's handbook, sort of address those issues and bring some of those tremendously large bursts a little bit more into line.
Yeah, and I every week here at the office I play in an epic game and have been for a while now, and I've experienced the table certainly has not gotten any bigger. So as my bursts get bigger for the wizard that I play in that game, it often just means I hit everything in the encounter. The other thing too that we've noticed as we play fourth edition, every week, sometimes multiple times a week over the last 3 years, is that the larger the burst gets and the more monsters there are in the encounter, there's a huge cost to gameplay because that means you are rolling more and more and more dice. And so that turn that you used to take that might have taken a couple of minutes suddenly is ballooning into the 10-minute turn for the one player at the table.
On the contrary, it is a great time for me to go get another beverage out of the fridge.
Yes. And in fact, when any of the other characters in our group who have huge area attacks like that use them, that's often when I do get up and get a new beverage.
Yeah, if I'm about to use one of those, I say, okay, guys, I'm going to be a while. Just, do your thing. I'll add up some numbers.
Yeah. Now, flip side is those abilities are often awesome fun. And so much of what we do is a balancing act of trying to find that middle road between creating, fabulous cinematic encounters that are true to, the spirit of high fantasy adventure in D&D, while at the same time not totally blowing gameplay.
Right. I mean, the burst 8 power that blows up everything in the combat is, especially when you get to epic tier, is probably, that's a great daily power. In the case of like Astral Wave, where it's a level 11 encounter power, that's a burst 8 is ridiculous. If every encounter you open up with, oh, by the way, let me attack every single monster I see, that's where it gets a little annoying.
Yeah.
And bad for gameplay, as you mentioned. The other Paragon path that we pulled into the Strength Cleric's bailiwick is the
Tactical War
the
Priest.
The Tactical War Priest, thank you.
People have noted that it's the one Paragon path where we made the attacks both strength attacks and wisdom attacks. Now, if we were going to redo everything, perhaps with the original cleric, we might have done that for all of them. In this case, we were trying to simply, again, turn some dials on various elements in the class to make things either more balanced, more playable, hopefully both, And if it can also be more fun on top of all of it, all the better.
It's also true that it was a little sad if the tactical war priest would not have been a good option for the war priest.
Yes, exactly. Well, and that points to one of the reasons why we didn't just flip the paragon path to strength. And that is, A, we wanted it to remain open to the war priest from Heroes of the Fallen Lands. But even more importantly, we know there are wisdom clerics from the Player's Handbook who already have that paragon path. And if we switched it all the way to strength, suddenly their paragon path becomes useless to them. So the compromise we made was, well, we'll make it available to both strength clerics and wisdom clerics.
Right.
A question that's come up a few times, this is kind of a smaller point, is, I'll go ahead and read it. The ritual casting portion of the update removed Gentle Repose as a declared given ritual, yet it's not listed in the summary of updates. Is this an oversight? This is similar to the divine keyword vanishing from the healing word power, in that this is not a change that occurred in this dragon article. Gentle Repose was dropped as sort of a forced ritual option on the cleric back in 2008, 2009, when we printed the deluxe Player's Handbook. And clerics, of course, can still take Gentle Repose, but really the intent was for clerics to have two options. And if, you know, if your cleric wants Gentle Repose to be one of those options, you can still certainly do that. But the intent a couple of years ago was for the cleric to be a bit more flexible than having one of their ritual choices pre-selected for them.
So we spent a lot of time talking about the cleric and answering those questions because, of course, we've had a lot of feedback on the cleric in recent days. I'm glad there's air conditioning here because it was getting a little warm on the forum.
Yes.
Coming up, we have the rogue and the wizard as part of the class compendium series. And then we have a similar article on the warlock after those are done. I don't know exactly the date on those, but I'm sure somebody will fill that in.
Yeah, the warlock is being done as a part of our regular update process rather than through the class compendium series. Right. Which will wrap up with the wizard. That wraps up this special edition of the D&D podcast, focusing on the class compendium series on Dragon. As ever, please send us your feedback on anything Dungeons & Dragons related, but we're particularly interested right now in your class compendium feedback. The email address you can use for that is dndinsider@wizards.com, and in the DND, that's the letter N, not an ampersand. As with all Dragon content, we look carefully at the feedback, not only that you send us by email, but also put in our forums, and apply that feedback where necessary. So please keep it coming, and keep on gaming. And thank you for Shu for joining us for this edition of the podcast.
Thanks for having me.